everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2023, and this is episode 342, which is a conversation about gene editing. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., an organization founded to equip Christians and pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal. It's called CRISPR Cures and the New World of Gene Editing, and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Jay, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
As always, it's great to be here.
Well, as I mentioned, Jay has written for us on something called gene editing. So first, before we get into some of the specifics of your article, why don't you describe for our listeners, what is gene editing, and specifically, what is CRISPR technology in gene editing?
Okay. Gene editing is the practice of trying to, so once we were able to map out the human genome, and we're able to, we're living in a really interesting time of the intersection of information processing that you see, and you hear about this more likely with like things like AI, and also genetics, where we have the capacity now to map out the human genome, and then to discover, like, if we have somebody who has this particular disease or this particular ailment or this particular illness or sickness, where it is affected on their DNA, on their genetic structure. So if it's a genetic issue, we can find the particular sequence of DNA of genetic information on their DNA. And gene editing has existed for a long time. And as the practice or the idea is that either what we would call somatic treatment, which is where we deal with adult cells, or later on, you know, talk about germline treatments, where we deal with things from the life from the moment it comes into existence, you edit the genetic material inside a human being in order to treat these particular ailments. Also used beyond that, but for the purposes we're talking about this type of gene editing, most of the purposes of the article that came up was an NPR discussion of a young woman who was cured of sickle cell, basically therapeutically cured of sickle cell. And so as we look at these treatments, it's where we go in, as opposed to treating the illness, we treat the body so that it reproduces healthy cells, and it takes care of the illness by just reproducing healthy cells in the body, and the illness is no longer a part of them because the body no longer has that flaw or that sequence that's a problem. And CRISPR, to get into what has happened over the last 12 years now, or last 10 years now, 2012 was when the article was published on CRISPR by the team led by a woman by the name of Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, I believe is how you pronounce her name, a French. They led a team, ultimately won the Nobel Prize. But the CRISPR goes back prior to them. What happened was, with looking into bacteria, largely the people who discovered it were working in yogurt, I believe, they noticed that there were what they call these repeating sequences in bacteria, and they're called palindromic repeating sequences. So if you have something really basic, like genetically, like a life form, like bacteria, you don't have a lot of inactive DNA in there. The coding in there is all pretty active. So when all of a sudden you notice that there's these repeating sequences that they're called palindromic repeating sequences, this is where we ultimately get the name CRISPR from, which is an acronym for clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. Now, that is a terrible word salad there, but the idea, they actually developed that so that they could call it CRISPR. They thought CRISPR sounded cool, so they used that. The acronym was decided on before what the acronym actually stood for, basically, because they wanted to have that CRISPR acronym. And what basically they figured out was that these sequences that were repeating themselves were part of a defense system that had been developed by bacteria against viral attacks. Imagine there's just a never-ending war between bacteria and viruses, and it happens on a scale much larger than we can imagine, because they outnumber us by many, you know, hundreds of millions to billions of all life on Earth. And so as they continually fight, bacteria developed a way to resist the viral attack. And what it did with these sequencing things was it would identify with an enzyme the genetic sequence of the virus it was trying to defend itself against. It would cut out that sequence that identified that virus, and it would plug it in to its own genetic sequence so that it was ready and prepared to fight against that virus. So what CRISPR did was take gene editing that was a very, very expensive, very difficult, very inaccessible, and not particularly wildly successful area, and it made it cheaper because we had this natural resource now that as we began to understand how this function worked, and that's what Dowden and Charpentier did with their team that ultimately wins them the Nobel Prize, is they figure out how this, what we call CRISPR-Cas9 works, how this combination of this enzyme and these RNA strands work together to be able to highlight a very particular sequence in a gene and then cut that out. And you can do anything. We can replace it with a code that we want in there. We can allow it to heal itself, which means it'll probably heal the mutation and put in something less harmful in there. We can actually turn things off and on. So if there's a gene sequence that's expressing itself, we can just go in there and turn it off. And they've gotten so good, they can actually replace particular proteins. Like they can go in and take it, replace a T with a C. And so gene editing looks to be able to read the entire sequence of a DNA, highlight the specific, maybe 20 protein sequence that we're looking for, cut that out, do stuff with it, modify it so that we take care of illness, disease, and things like that, but primarily as a therapeutic tour. So that's what gene editing and particularly CRISPR does. CRISPR is the defense mechanism of a bacteria versus a virus that has been mapped out by scientists and is now being used to be able to make very clean, very accurate edits to a human genome.
That sounds like it's miracle working, but also it sounds like there could be some ethical issues involved. Now, you mentioned someone who had sickle cell disease, and in the United States in particular, the population that's mostly impacted by sickle cell is a Black community. And of course, you know, there's just a lot of complex issues with the greater Black community as a whole in terms of access to healthcare, good healthcare, quality healthcare. And so just some of these different issues, I mean, how is, you know, some of these CRISPR treatments that seem very promising, you know, how will they be able to be used by a majority of the population that needs it? And maybe, you know, especially people, you don't want them to, you know, suffer from a disease because they can't afford treatments. And we see this kind of all the time, at least in the, you know, this is a different discussion in terms of access to medical care. But I mean, everyone should realize that we have great medical care in terms of the quality of it. And then people who have the money can get the best quality, almost concierge kind of healthcare, like to find the right doctors till they get answers to their particular disease.
Yeah. And you know, when you talk about, let's say, concierge level upkeep, we're talking about just the capacity to go in and get physicals, to monitor your health, to feel that comfort with the medical community, because that it's, let's look at when you talk about the Black community, because we talk about sickle cell and that one of the reasons that sickle cell was immediately on the radar for CRISPR researchers as soon as they realized what they were going to be able to do, which was immediately. The moment that they realized they could control this thing, these are brilliant people. They immediately saw the implications for what they were going to be able to accomplish. And they highlight something like sickle cell because we know exactly the problem on the genetic structure in the DNA that needs to be fixed to stop sickle cell. So that would be, you know, and so it immediately comes on the radar. Now, the interesting thing is at this point, then it most impacts the Black community in the United States. The sub-Saharan population in Africa, some Mediterranean population, and some Caribbean populations that have been derived from those genetic populations. So you have a group of people who have a troubling relationship with the medical community, right? It's not, you see this when you read about what's going on with the Black community in the United States, and you heard about this a lot during COVID as well, that there was a delay in seeking medical help because you're talking about a population that has a history of distrust with the medical community, in many ways painfully earned after having not being treated as human. And this is a felt distrust that even goes to very educated. I remember, I think you and I talked about it on a previous podcast and mentioned an article, but I, in prepping for another article one time, I'd read this account of this highly educated, highly successful Black woman who had to go to the doctor. And she said, every time she goes to the doctor, she puts on her Ivy League sweatshirt because she feels like she'll be treated differently when she goes there. So now it's one thing when you're just talking about physicals and health upkeep, but now you're talking about hundreds, let's say 100,000. That's the number that we generally use. 100,000 Black Americans, for the most part, in the United States that are dealing with sickle cell disease. And you now have what looks like a therapy that will, as far as we can tell, cure them or reduce their suffering greatly. Because sickle cell disease is, it's a problem where the blood that transports the oxygen malforms and it becomes misshapen and it doesn't flow as well. And when it starts to build up in certain particular, cause what they call pain crisis events for people suffering from sickle cell. Pain is just unbearable. It also destroys their organs. This is something they don't get to live a normal life because there's no prediction of when these pain crisis events will happen. They can have as many as four or more major crises a year, and it's completely debilitating. And their whole life becomes about controlling the pain. Now, there's treatments for it that require them to go to the hospital regularly and receive blood transfusions and things like that. But this is a group of people that they've treated, and one who's mentioned in the NPR article, Victoria Gray, who went through a cycle of treatment with CRISPR technology, where they identified differences between people who were not having as many events and people who were. And in this, what they did was they were able to say, look, you have fetal blood cells that are produced when you're young, and they're gradually replaced by adult blood cells. So the fetal blood cells in sickle cell people and people who are suffering from sickle cell disease are not affected by sickle cell, but the adult cells are. And people who, for whatever reason, that biological weirdness, they continue to produce fetal blood cells during the course of their life suffer far less than the people who don't. And so they said, if we could get these people's bone marrow to produce their fetal blood cells instead of their adult blood cells, then we can reduce or maybe even eliminate these events because they'll have healthy cells and not the sickle cells that are a result of this. And so they removed cells, they genetically modified them, then they put these people through chemotherapy to kill the blood cells in their bone marrow. This was not an easy thing that they underwent. And then after chemotherapy, they put these new genetically modified blood cells into their bone marrow. And lo and behold, for most of them, for almost all of them, it began to produce these fetal cells that have been modified not to have any long-term effects on them. And they're living healthy, normal lives now, almost all of them. And even the people who weren't supposedly or apparently cured by it are living much more functional lives and dealing with far fewer pain crisis events. The problem is it's $1 million per person for that treatment. For a community that already feels like they can't trust the medical community and whom by and large could not possibly afford that. And so what do you do now? This isn't like upkeep. We're getting better. The CRISPR researchers are just going to get better at treating sickle cell disease as we move forward. But we're right now at a place where we can change the lives of people who are living in near constant pain and life disruptive events. If only we can afford to treat each person individually, but 100,000 people and $1 million of treatment is outrageously expensive. So this has gone before the government, as they said, look, we obviously have a duty to help these people, but we'll bankrupt the government if we start a precedent of saying every time we develop a treatment that will cure somebody, the government will take the responsibility of paying for that treatment when that treatment costs $1 million a pop. And so it does immediately. And I think it's interesting because Dostoevsky wrote about this in his book, The Idiot, back in, I think, like 1868, where he said, like, scientific advancement is divisive by its nature. It immediately divides those who have the resources to be able to benefit from it from those who don't. And so every time something new comes into existence, it creates a class of people who can't have access to it. And that's important to some of the CRISPR researchers as well. How do we develop these things and then profit from that development, because it was an incredibly expensive and labor intensive process, and promote creativity in these areas, while at the same time be sensitive to the idea that if we can cure people of a terribly debilitating illness, we have to do that. We can't just leave them sitting there. And you have Senators Booker and Senator Scott, who are both focusing on this area, particularly with sickle cell. Obviously, they have a reason to do so. You have two powerful Black men in the Senate who are looking at their community and saying, we want to find ways to help. But it does raise questions, because you could say, well, let's just fix sickle cell if we can do that now. But if you start that precedent, then you bankrupt the government, because every time we come up with a new treatment, and we're going to be coming up with new treatments all the time, the precedent has been set that we as a community take on the payment of it. And this just, these are incredibly expensive treatments right now.
At CRI, we make sure that we keep up with the latest trends and issues by subscribing to secular news sources. One of those is the New York Times. And I was reading their magazine recently. And last month in March 2023, there was an article they published called "Your Data is Diminishing Your Freedom." And it's they were talking to someone who is the author of "How We Became Our Data." And interestingly, that is a good subject for us for the future. I'm sure there's a lot of philosophical and ethical issues attached to that. But it is interesting that this is what is happening online, and that's why there's the algorithm. And in order to help us with the algorithm that's always changing, we need your assistance by you giving a rating or review. Now, Apple Podcasts is kind of where everything like that is housed. Even if you're getting this podcast on another one of your favorite platforms, it's where kind of all the comments are aggregated best. So if you can go there, that would be so great if you could give us a review and rating. And I'm super thankful for some of the users who've done that most recently, including JSM JWLB, who has the headline "Always Interesting" and wrote this comment, quote, "The topics are relevant, insightful, and sometimes unusual, but always informative. I enjoy the wide spectrum of subjects ranging from movie reviews to today's controversial subjects. I appreciate the biblical worldview that is always front and center," end quote. So thank you so much to that user who did give us a recent rating review, and we would love more of those. It really helps us, as I say, with the algorithm. And I'm sure you have friends that would appreciate our focus on biblical worldview as we cover theological, ethical, and cultural apologetics. And so if you can head on over to Apple Podcasts and give us that review, we would be so grateful. Just a short sentence or two. What do you appreciate about this? And it helps everybody else on the internet know why they should tune in. Another way that you can help us out is to give us a tip. Really easy to do so. Head on over to equip.org, click Journal, Postmodern Realities Podcast. At every single one of the landing pages, there's a link. So we appreciate all the ways that you partner with us. It's simply just, like I said, telling a friend. That's great. And we appreciate you listening. So now back to my conversation with Jay Watts about gene editing. So in addition, you said that they're always working on this technology, and they're discovering new things all the time. So in addition to sickle cell, are there other therapies that are being developed for other diseases that would be impacted for the better in terms of cures because of the CRISPR technology?
Yeah. I mean, if they can identify where the genetic sequence is and what it is that's a problem, they are working on it right now to use CRISPR to deal with it. It's the access. When I said it cost $1 million per treatment, that I don't want it to sound like CRISPR costs that much money. That's the point of CRISPR, is that it's actually relatively inexpensive and incredibly accessible versus other but you still have to go through chemo. You still have to have the medical team working with them. It still takes over a year of medical people working alongside them at the way that is treated right now. But yeah, there's particular types of blindness that are being addressed with this, the sense that we'll be able to cure the most common forms of blindness that children are enduring with, because we know what the gene is causing it, and we can go in and fix that. Huntington's disease is something. I've read articles about when they're working on cancer, where they say, look, this is much more promising than current, because what we can do is we can identify the particular type of cancer that this individual has, because every cancer has a unique code right to it. And then we can help their body by editing genes to fight that cancer at that source. I heard one doctor describe it as, they said, the spot where cancer exists in your body is like a sewer genetically, in the sense that it's just a lot going on there and the body can't deal with it. And it starts to mess with the immune system. But if you can train the defense mechanism of a human being to identify that very specific kind of cancer that's growing in your body, and then sick it on it like you would sick a dog or something that's been trained to go after a very specific thing, then you can treat cancer very efficiently without any of the long-term effects that we see right now with things like radiation and chemo. Almost any area that you can imagine, they're actively working on trying to deal with it as a treatment plan using this, because not just for altruistic reasons, because the profit from being able to create these cures is immense, and the patents that people are filing as often as they can and fighting over these patents, it's this industry, this area, this group of people that are working in CRISPR has grown in the last 10 years to be a massive medical and scientific effort. And anything that they can identify genetically that they think that they can edit the cells, even some, it's just as easy as turn that cell off, turn that protein off. It's working. All you got to do is go and turn an off switch on the DNA, and you can do that. We can just turn it off. So it's staggering, the number of things that are being worked on right now with this particular medical technology and scientific technology.
Well, listeners will know that several episodes ago, we had an in-depth dive into, you know, the whole fertility industry and just how different treatments are impacting, you know, reproductive technologies. And this one is also affecting reproductive technology. So I know that there were some international agreements put into place restricting a practice in reproductive technology of germline editing. So can you tell us what that is, and why would there need to be international agreements as this is applied to reproductive technologies?
So germline editing, if you think of it in the most basic ideas possible, there's things that we can edit genetic material on that will cure people of certain problems, but that when they have children, their children will not inherit that cure. That's somatic cell therapeutic treatment, right? If we do germline treatment, then let's say you have Huntington's, but you want to have children. Well, they would genetically modify any children that you had, so that the moment they come into existence, Huntington's just doesn't exist in them. And when those children had children and their children had children, we have genetically removed that from that line. No one's going to. So any of these areas where you see somebody that has cystic fibrosis, where you have these things that we pass on to the next generation, the promise of germline editing is that we can change people at the very moment they come into existence, so that the change that we made exists in every cell of their body, as opposed to very specific cells that we targeted with somatic treatment in adults or more mature human beings. And the reason that that's scary is multiple. Number one is unintended consequences. There are unintended consequences with all medical treatments, side effects, things we don't understand. When you're talking about genetically altering human beings, we really don't have a timeline on how long it will take for us to see those unintended consequences. So, say we alter a genetic code and the environment never puts any pressure on that, because all of the expressions that we see, the genetic expressions we see, are usually a combination of environmental factors and genetic information that preexisted those factors. So let's say that the environmental factors that trigger whatever the negative thing don't start to show up until, just for the sake of argument, 25 years after we start altering making germline edits in other people. Well, if a segment of the population started having kids and they're carrying with them an altered genetic line that we didn't understand the problems with, and they've passed that on, and that's a heritable trait. Now, every time somebody has kids, they're passing that on. They're multiplying the number of people in society that have this. And we didn't, because we made germline edits without even fully understanding what the response, what that would do long-term with other environmental pressures that express themselves. So that's one thing. They represent a danger there. The other thing about germline edits that becomes creepy is that they tend to change the way we look at nascent human life, very early human life, because now let's go beyond cures. I mean, sure, I can remove Huntington's disease. I can remove cystic fibrosis. I can remove blindness. I can remove any of these sickle cell. I can remove any of these things so that nobody ever has to be born with those again. And within a couple of generations, they will be wiped out from the human experience. I can also make you blue-eyed if you want I can make you blonde haired. I can make you tall. I can make you smart. I can make you athletic. Is anything that I can highlight and determine the genes, I can edit. And so now we start to look at the next generation as something like a commodity or something that exists for our pleasure and not something that exists for its own purpose, not the replacement generation, not the people that will be one day replacing us, not individual humans with a life and a destiny of their own, but we start picking and choosing what we would like them to be. And that represents danger. So the idea of germline, the dangers involved with it, just had the whole community. None of these people were saying they never want to do germline edits. What they were saying is, as we're working on somatic treatments, was working on therapeutic treatments for people and more mature people, let's everyone just agree that this is not the time to run around doing germline edits. And if we ever are going to do germline edits, there's a series of criteria that have to be met because we all have to agree that fundamentally changing the genetic structure of human beings is a serious step. Maybe not a step, and certainly they don't think a step that they should never cross. They're going to want to get rid of certain diseases because they're just horrifying. But they're saying, before we do that, let's do these other things that we have a reason to work on. And if we're going to do germline editing, it better be on something that we just have to do because there's no way to treat it, no medical treatments we can offer, no relief for anybody through any other means other than to just make sure that the next generation doesn't have this.
Well, the promise of eradicating various diseases sounds interesting. Like you said, there was this international agreement that that dealt with this. And back in 2018, actually, a Chinese scientist made an announcement on YouTube claiming that he had implanted genetically edited embryos that came, you know, that were carried to birth, that came to term. And so that seems like to me a violation of this international agreement. So what was his reasoning about why he did that? And how did the actual CRISPR research community respond? I mean, were they excited about this? What was their response?
No. And it was immediate, right? I mean, in the sense that they all agreed, let's hold off on germline editing. And Hey Jiankiu, I think it was, he immediately said, I'm going to do germline editing. So it wasn't as if a long period had passed. Now, if you read, you know, about him, it sounds like there was, let's give him both the benefit of the doubt. In one area, he grew up in an area where HIV was very destructive to his community. But in another, we have enough evidence to suggest from his own communications that he genuinely believed that he would be like the Neil Armstrong of gene editing, that his name would go down in history as the first person to edit germ level changes and to cure a disease. So what he wanted to do was he wanted to create human life through gene editing that could not possibly become infected with HIV. And he did that by attacking the particular cell protein where HIV needs to be able to attach itself to the immune system of a healthy individual. And so he edits that so it has no ability to attach. HIV cannot infect this human being. And he tried multiple times to get it and it didn't work. So we're talking here already about embryo destruction, creating embryos and then destroying them during this process of trying to create a life that wasn't capable of getting HIV. And then he ultimately had two twins or a twin. And then they say another one later that were born that carried this. The immediate response from the scientific community, particularly the CRISPR community, which is its own community within the scientific community, was condemnation. Because he violated everything. For example, they said, you know, it has to be something for which we can't treat. Well, there are treatments for HIV that make it something that you can live with. And so the risks that are involved with germline changes didn't seem necessary to the scientific community. There's already treatments being worked on for adults using on somatic treatments and therapeutic treatments with CRISPR to deal with HIV. So again, this was a step that didn't seem necessary. He didn't go through the safety protocols that were necessary. He didn't get the approval. Even Chinese scientists condemned him. And ultimately he goes to trial and gets convicted of illegal experimentation. No, and it's interesting because the scientific community condemned him immediately, because one of the reasons is you hear some of them will admit, I'm not against germline editing. It was this particular kind of germline editing. And the reason that we wanted people to not do it was because right now they understood that there's a distrust between the scientific community and the community at large. And that as people hear about things like gene editing, they start to think of the worst possible scenarios that could happen from gene editing. And then they see an irresponsible scientist doing what he was doing, and it will only make it harder for them to get the funding and the appreciation for the work that they're doing. And so that the immediate response from almost all of the scientific community was harsh and condemning. It was interesting. The public response was not that. I think that the public has a hard time understanding exactly what's being talked about a lot of times with CRISPR. I know I had that experience while working on this article. I talked to a lot of people to find out what they knew about this, and almost nobody knew anything about it. And if they did, they knew very little. So I don't know if the lack of response from the general public was because they just didn't care, or if it was because it was still a subject matter they don't fully grasp what's going on. But the people who work in that field professionally at an academic, scholarly, and in these labs, all of these people immediately and loudly condemned it. And the young man or the Chinese scientist didn't get anything that he wanted to get out of this. He didn't get fame. He didn't get remembered for being a great man that changed the world. He didn't get remembered for curing HIV. He got jail time, a fine, and he is banned from ever working in reproductive sciences again.
So just in your informal poll of people, did they think that CRISPR technology, while it has some ethical concerns, like for the most part, would be a positive thing if we could just, you know, be able to fix genes so that we can really eradicate some very serious illnesses?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I would say that most people that I talked to's response was very measured. And there's reasons to be measured. We have been promised miracle cures before, and they don't materialize. This is different in some of the things that we've seen in the past. The promises, the successes that we've already seen, the precision with which it operates. There are reasons to be very optimistic. I think most people were measured in their optimism. I talked to a lot of people. Most of the people I talked to did not have an immediately negative reaction to it, nor did they immediately see any areas of concern. But it was as if they knew those areas were there because they would ask me questions and say, and searching, fishing conversationally, is there something here that we need to be concerned with? Because it all sounds so incredibly promising. It is on its own as a mechanism. It is an incredibly promising thing. But going back to the Chinese scientists that created those babies with that can't catch HIV. I mean, he used early life as a resource during that process with no thought whatsoever to what he was doing to that. And that's pretty common in these research areas. And so the manner by which they're doing their work is already on some levels problematic for those of us who have an inclusive view of human value, who think that all human life ought to be treated with dignity and respect. But the ends that they can reach are so promising that, yeah, I would say the general reaction for people is to be optimistic, measured optimism when you try to talk to them about this.
Now, I know that there's also like biohackers involved in this. So can you tell our listeners what is a biohacker and just some of the things that you're talking about too? If people are going to make some progress in this, do they have to do a lot of experimentation and different test different processes on, you know, human fetal cells, for example?
Yes. Okay. So this is interesting. And there's a remarkable parallel on my own for other projects that I was working on. I've been looking at AI a lot and reading as much as I can about the digital information revolution that we're in the middle of right now. And that's why I see you have these two streams running together and they're producing remarkable results on this side of it. I want to use that as an example because that's where the term biohackers comes from. So the hacking community is actually a very productive community in many ways for learning about computers and learning about programs. They push creativity. They push the world forward because it's open source. They all share all the information that they have with each other, and they're constantly looking for advancement. Now, some of it's nefarious, and some of it is just like almost, it's not almost, some of it's terroristic in its nature in the sense of how they impact other people. But by introducing this open source dealing with computers and information, this massive number of intelligent people working on these issues all of the time, either formally or informally, advances things much faster than they would be had you not had these hackers, for lack of a better term, out there working. Biohackers are the same, but in the biotechnology field. They want to take what's being worked on in labs and take it out of labs and introduce it into the lives of people who are very smart and very capable, but are not operating under the same structure as these formal institutions that are working on these issues. And so for biohackers, when it comes to CRISPR, are already out there active and have been for years, where they sell CRISPR packets for you to do your own CRISPR experimentations at home and to see what you can do. They are less, when I say they're less structured, they are, you know, they're as varied as there are people out there that are willing to do this out of curiosity. Some of them, one particular guy that I've read, he thinks he would fall in line with what we would call a transhumanist or posthumanist. He doesn't want to help humanity. He wants to get past humanity. And so he sees when the rest of the world was condemning the birth of these HIV resistant children, he was celebrating it because this means that we should all be doing this now. Let's start adapting everybody, editing everybody before they're born. He sees the chance as a mechanism for determining your genetic destiny as something archaic and to be gotten past and gotten beyond. And so let's move to a point where we choose our genetic destiny of the people after us, not where we're required to take whatever we got through the genetic roll of the dice of our parents. And so these people are reckless. I mean, in a way that the scientific community is not, right? I mean, the one gentleman that's mentioned in a book called The Codebreaker, he injects himself with CRISPR technology on stage, saying that I've been giving this to frogs and their leg muscles have gotten bigger. Should I inject myself and see if I can target my own leg muscles and they'll get bigger and stronger? So their belief is that we will advance all of this more quickly in the same way that it worked for the computer industry, if we open source it to a group of people who are smart, who are capable, who are willing to experiment, who are operating outside of the established structures and are willing to take risk or chances that other people aren't, testing on themselves in ways that other people are not. And so that's a danger because they're embracing the idea of germline editing, but we have no reason to believe that they're operating in good faith. They've actually said that they're not. They're not trying to protect humanity in the sense of they see humanity as something to be gotten beyond oftentimes, and that enhancements are a great thing and designer babies are a great thing and turning us into something that we're not already is a great thing and that we should all be moving forward on that. So biohackers are people that are just out there like computer hackers, but they're trying to hack the human genome and adjust it and change it in any way they can. And that's I think hackers, you know, obviously hackers can be very dangerous in the real world with computers, but when you're talking about genetically altering human life, it's a dangerous game.
So I want to ask you, like, how does the Christian ethically, you know, deal with this particular issues? I mean, what do they need to think about, especially as they, read more stories about gene editing? Because, you know, like you said, when you talk to people, their initial thing is that'd be good. And there are so many parents that have children that have illnesses. I mean, I think you've heard the stories about people who've had other babies so that they can have children that could help cure their other children. But instead of doing that, what if they could just have a baby that didn't have this illness? I mean, wouldn't that be a good thing? And so how should the Christian deal with this? And is it something that Christians shouldn't participate in? Or as the technology grows, is it something that they could, you know, because it is biblical, that they could engage in really seriously considering the use of CRISPR technology?
I think let's go back to Victoria Gray, who was the woman who was, let's say, therapeutically cured of sickle cell disease, that the NPR story that that started this article and thinking about these issues. When she was speaking at a conference in London to CRISPR scientists and researchers, she was talking about this in terms of spiritual things. She was saying this was a miracle. She didn't, maybe, you know, maybe you don't understand miracle in the way that she's talking about it as a direct intervention of God doing something miraculous in her life, but that this type of advancement to take someone, because this is a woman who was debilitated, that she could not function in a normal human life the way that everyone around her could, that wasn't living well with sickle cell disease. And now she can. Now she can go to museums and ride the London Eye and do all of these things that other people can't do. And for her, the term miracle is not misapplied. For her, she says there is no tension between science and God. God used you to cure people like me. And so we can't begrudge someone like that that is experiencing a new life. But I do think it's necessary for us to ask at what cost. At what cost to us as human beings? How are they going about their business? And here's something I heard years and years ago. A person who was not a Christian and was an atheist and a scientist, and they were saying, the problem with Christians is that they wait until the genie is out of the bottle to complain about something. They didn't bother to learn about what we were making while we were making it. They waited until it's already out there being used, and then they got outraged by it. And by that time, there's no way to pull it back. It's out there. It's being used. The reality is CRISPR is out there, and there's nothing we can do about it. But what we can do right now is do our best to learn about how this is advancing and try our best to demand ethical practices as they go forward, not to exploit early human life as a resource unnecessarily, and I don't know when it's ever necessary to be allowed to kill another human being in order to advance the cause of another human being. So we go to them and look at what's happening and say, we want to be able to enjoy the fruits of this labor like everybody else, but understand, we have deep reservations about how some people are doing this, and we would like to see those practices protected. We would like to see as much as we can. We're not going to get it from certain elements because the biohackers don't care, and because at the end of the day, the people that are rushing for to get patents and the profits off all of this are not going to care. But we have to have a prophetic voice. We even talked about, you and I talked about this back when we were discussing vaccines and whether or not we can be directly connected to the evil that's been done in the past to produce some of the research materials that are used to produce vaccines. And it becomes a vaccine to vaccine, treatment to treatment thing that we have to evaluate. So I think for Christians, we need to be aware of what's going on. And we need to be aware of how they're advancing these things. And when we have issues, we need to speak up and be willing to say, don't pursue things like that. Don't do something that's going to leave out an entire group of a large group of the human population from being able to enjoy the fruits of your work because you were rushing to get the patents or rushing to get the treatment because of the profits that you would enjoy there, as opposed to being able to do this in an ethical way that will allow all of us to not feel compromised by enjoying what we were capable to enjoy. I think it's meaningful to me. I say this, it is meaningful to me that this discovery was made in life. And what I mean by that was that when we hear about this too, when we're looking for particular cures or therapies in other ways and chemistry and things like that, where we find these treatments in nature and we're able to make them work for us. And in this particular case, this wasn't something manufactured in a lab. It was discovered in the natural defenses of a bacteria against a virus. And in that, in and of itself, I think speaks to why it was able to be developed so quickly. It was life, dealing with life, and we were able to map it out. And those scientists who were brilliant, I don't want to undermine their brilliance. I mean, what they did was amazing, but so many of them converged on the same idea all at once. I mean, Doudna and Charpentier, they get the Nobel Prize, but they just beat other groups to it. Right? It wasn't like they were the only ones doing this. The advancements of this has happened so fast because it's so easy to understand and so easy to access for these people and so easy to use. And that shouldn't be lost on us, that nature gave us an incredible device. God gave us an incredible device through his natural order to be able to do things for people. And so I think that we can, and we just have to draw our own lines. I mean, I talk to my kids about this all the time. Before you get into a scenario, you should have considered as much as possible before you get there what your rules are and of engagement. And we need to start thinking about our rules of engagement with these types of biotechnology and think deeply about what it means to us. The scientific community will have their rules of engagement. The biohackers will have their rules of engagement. Different international groups will have different rules of engagement. And the Christians need to sit down and think very seriously about how we interact with this and where we need to make our voice heard when we feel like the protocol that are being used to develop these cures is in violation of our ethics. But at the same time, Miss Gray is now enjoying a life that she didn't have before. And for her, there's a miracle there because her life has been transformed. And that miracle will be there for many people that are living with ailments or disorders that I can't even imagine what they're going through. I have a type 1 diabetic in my house. I'm well aware, number one, that many of the people that are searching for cures for type 1 diabetes are doing so in a way that I deem deeply unethical and have written about it and spoken about it. And the other side of that is that I would like my daughter to be able to go to bed at night without having to worry about dying of diabetes. I mean, that's a tension in my household. And I know other people that will feel those same tensions with the people in their lives. And so we have to interact with medicine as it exists and with biotechnology that exists. And we need to think very deeply about our rules of engagement, about where we're going to draw lines that we won't cross and where we're going to speak up when we see those lines being crossed by others and where we are going to feel good about human beings who have lived a life limited that are now set free. So it is. It's a very complicated issue. I wish I had an easy answer. I don't think there is one. I think that it just is going to require us to be mindful about what's going on in the world and very intentionally say. And that's the thing that I took away from all the people that I talked to was that they didn't understand what was going on. And this has been going on, again, I said, since 2012. And that they suddenly felt a need to understand better what was going on. Because they understood this does apply to me. It will apply to us all sooner or later. This will be a way that people are treated across the spectrum of illness. And by the way, it's also being used, and this is not less controversial, in editing food and creating things like, let's create a particular kind of cooking oil, vegetable oil, that doesn't have bad properties for your heart or your circulation or anything like that. So.
But it seems to me that people are against genetically modified food. Like they don't want to eat genetically modified food because they don't know that much about it. And you were mentioning cost earlier, and that would be a fascinating thought because, well, it's so expensive, but what if we could cure cancer? Or what if we could make sure that nobody was born disabled by just choosing different kinds of genes or editing them? What if we put all of our money in medicine in that way? Is there something lost about being human when we get rid of all disability and disease?
Here's the risk for me is that when we can cure, that you start to look at those people who suffer from things as living a life less meaningful, right? That's initially a problem. There have been conversations in the book, The Codebreaker. There's a conversation with a young man who suffers and lives with sickle cell disease. And when they talk to him about eradicating sickle cell disease, he is torn on it because he says, I am who I am because of and I've learned things and I've developed character. But other people don't feel that way. And that's the question, right? Who chooses for them before they have the ability to choose for themselves? That's the ethical issue that we get ourselves into. There is one thing that I am certain of that I've talked to medical doctors before. Number one, we always overpromise what can be delivered. Always overpromise what can be delivered. And I think we oversee it. Now we could see this across a lot of, and I'm going to get into some of them, but we can see this right now in our culture and a lot of things. But let's look at cancer that we've mentioned a couple of times on this show. We're radiation treatments and chemotherapy. There's treatments for people that are dealing with cancer. And when they're effective and cancer goes into remission, those people still deal with the effects of the treatment. They're long-term effects of the treatment that they went through. Same thing, by the way, for these people that like Victoria Gray being cured of sickle cell disease. Well, she had to go through chemotherapy to be cured in the way that she is right now. And we're hoping that cure is going to stay. To this point, it looks like it's going to hold. But chemotherapy brings its own level of problems and its own. And so if we accept the idea that, number one, we'll always overpromise what we can deliver. Number two, we're never going to be away from sickness. There is no cure for all sickness. This can't possibly do it because we can't predict all sickness. Viruses change and mutate all the time. We've learned that lesson you know, painfully over the last 5 or 6 years, new illnesses develop. I remember talking to people about why Alzheimer's seems to be a late 20th century arrival. And this is when, you know, people started living longer. And because we didn't die of pneumonia, we started to become aware of other issues, right? That, you know, 150 years ago, most people died of pneumonia. And that was the way people would die. They would catch pneumonia. They would go to sleep. It was actually seen as a very peaceful way to die. We took care of that with antibiotics. And so now people live longer than they did before because we have antibiotic treatments and advanced medical treatments. But what do? We found out that there were other things that were going to be problems, and that there are other things that we won't be able to treat with this type of treatment. So the idea that we're going to get rid of illness is just not possible. But when you talk about eliminating genetics, there is an interesting question, because you hear from people on all sides of that. Some people who are struggling with genetic issues will say, well, no, I want to be cured, but I don't think the idea of nobody who have ever had to go through what I went through existing is a good idea, because I learned so much by going through it. But then you have other people who respond to that nonsense. There's other ways to learn that don't require you to go through a debilitating genetic disease or genetic disorder. And so, I mean, the whole conversation is once exciting and terrifying. And that's true of AI, by the way, as well. When you get to this place where it's difficult to look beyond what we can and can't do, we don't even fully understand the questions to ask about what the world on the other side of this will look like if it advances the way that we think it will advance. We don't even know what questions to ask yet. And that's where we are right now. This happened so fast and dropped like a bomb on the scientific community. And it's so useful and so precise. And we're just now figuring out some of the issues that come along with it. But when we talk about the idea of, will at the end of the day, we be able to cure everything, and should we cure everything? You know, I think that there's some judgment. I think a world without Huntington's is a better world. And didn't God make us to be good? And so he wants to restore us to full flourishing of what it means to be a human being. I think when we get to level enhancements and augmentation, that's a whole different matter. But we're talking about therapeutically treating illness, using, you know, the means by which God gave us in his created order. I think that's all good. It's just the methods that we're using to get there that is somewhat troubling. And then the risk that you're willing to take when you get into things like germline editing that have to be very, very, very watched. Because I do think that the more reasonable voices in the scientific community are right to say we should only do that when the cost of not doing it is a level of human suffering that's unnecessary. So the act of doing it has a level of necessity to it. We just can't treat what these people have. So let's eliminate it before the next generation has it.
It's really interesting, because when you think of sometimes just in people who study, you know, different species, for example, people think, well, wouldn't it be great if we could just eradicate, you know, all roaches or all mosquitoes or things that we think are pests, rats. But then they realized if they got rid of everything of a certain species, it could wreak havoc that they didn't know that what happened, even though nobody likes a roach or a mosquito or rats.
Yeah, 30 years ago, I don't think anybody knew how important honeybees were to our ecosystem. And now we're painfully aware of what happens to these any particular ecosystem when you don't have honeybees. Yeah, that's absolutely true. There are unintended consequences to every step that we take. This has been an interesting conversation I've had with several college kids recently, because we're discussing the view, and there's worldviews that are hidden in here, right? And that's what I think the Christian worldview brings to this, something very important, because those who see us as just biological meat machines, there is no right and wrong really for them. There's only advancement of their cause, and their cause largely is getting us to this level of, they don't care about augmentation. They love augmentation. Let's just go, because all we are is biology. And what the human brain brings to this, and so they see things in sort of a progressive way. And what I mean is that we're just getting better and better and better. If you believe that human beings can be placed into an environment where if the environment were just right, then all human beings would behave appropriately, then you just have a different worldview than the Christian worldview holds. We see all human beings as living in a fallen world, in some level redeemed either through Christ or seeking or being called by Christ or living in rebellion against God, open rebellion against him. And And so we see a brokenness to the world, and we understand that everything is a compromise. We're trying to do the best that we can, but because we're operating in this broken world, everything that we do will ultimately have some unintended consequence that is negative. And you can see this work itself out in politics. You can see it work itself out in science all the time. We do one thing that we think is great, but because of the nature of the world that we live in and the agents that are operating within it, we didn't see or foresee this as a result of the good we were trying to do. But we knew that that was going to happen before we did it. Didn't go into this, like I said, over-promising. And that's the risk, is over-promising or an unreasonable belief that we're on the verge of everything being cured. We're not there. And that rush, though, to get to this, to find out what we can do, can lead to reckless practices. We've already seen it lead to the reckless commodification of early human life being used as a resource for others so that they can develop therapies. You already hear it in the biohackers who see no something inherently wrong with risking testing themselves and other people all around them with genetically modifying information with no idea of what the consequences will be. It's not like you had a computer that crashed or you lost your job. If you fundamentally transform your DNA into an unhealthy arrangement, you die. And, at best, you have issues. We're talking about passing them on to other people. So it's an amazing time to try to evaluate what's the good that can be done through this and what are the risks inherent in it. And how do we involve ourselves? How do we navigate through this? And that's why I think this time that we live in has required Christians and all human beings to develop a more robust view of what it means to be a human being than any other time that's ever existed, by coming to the public and being able to say every single human life matters. And that's been at the center of every great human rights movement that has ever existed on this planet, and everything that's great about us, including overcoming adversity to find a better way to treat each other, a more inclusive view of humanity and society. All of this has been driven by this idea that human beings matter. So as we get to this place where we can affect, impact, change, and alter human beings in a way that we never could before, we need to be the voice in this generation and in this culture that says, be careful, because the life you alter matters. Diseased or not, it matters. Disabled or not, it matters. And so we have to be very cautious that we don't become so consumed with the idea that some of these people are living a life of less flourishing than we would like them to lead, that we don't start transforming people recklessly or editing things recklessly or making decisions recklessly because we've deemed it would be better without it. So your warning is well taken. History is replete with moves that were intended to do good that did terrible things to people.
And two, I was thinking you don't want to introduce somehow a level of classes in any culture. In other words, like you said, overpromising. Well, we couldn't cure these diseases, but we did cure these diseases. So therefore, all of these healthy people that benefited from gene editing are better than these other people. And suddenly, maybe they couldn't get other kinds of healthcare because their particular illness could not be cured.
Yes, the dehumanizing nature of reality is stark, and it's troubling how quickly that can happen. It's troubling how quickly you can, and I mean this not just in a sense of observational, but if you look at psychological experiments that have been done on people, and this goes beyond just something like the Stanford Prison Experiment, which is a very famous example of that, where you took psychologically evaluated and healthy people and put them into a dynamic where one group had power over another, and overnight the power was abused. The prisoners that are just students that have volunteered for this are dehumanized. I was talking to an educator who was telling me about a similar experiment with eye color that they did in a classroom where they started to ostracize blue-eyed people, and the children very quickly picked up on if the teacher categorized blue-eyed children as lesser, then the students began to think of them as lesser almost immediately. And so it's an infection, I think, a psychological and spiritual infection in our world to allow our distraction from Christ and from God and from all that is good to lead us to dehumanize the brothers and sisters around us. And we do it in small and big ways all the time, right? When we see our own pursuit of our own success over other people and don't worry about what happens to them as we pursue our own greatness. We are dehumanizing them. We're saying our success is more important to them. In the practice of abortion, when we look at our life and the life that we want to lead, and we see this life that's come into existence, and we say we should be able to destroy it so that we can pursue these other things, we have dehumanized them. We have made them less important than the goals that I wanted to reach. And in this particular case, you're right. I mean, anytime. And I think that's interesting. That's why I thought it was so interesting that Dostoevsky wrote about this all the way back in like 1868. Anytime we're able to create a class of people that have access to the latest level of technology or can benefit from that, we're immediately creating a class of people that can't. And how will that divide up our understanding of those people? And the Christian voice is important here to be able to see all people as mattering, all people being important, every single one of them being the image bearers of God, every single one of them to which we have duties and obligations. And I think that that's what we bring to the table in our community. And we have to be, I mean, if I can't be passionate about that, that's one of the things always people ask me about my job, because they think my job's hard. It's like, are you kidding? Taking a message to the world that every human being ought to be treated with dignity and respect is the easiest thing I ever do in my life. And that, to me, that is the easiest thing I ever get to do, is to look at somebody that's dehumanized another, not thinking about another, dismissing another human being and saying, brother, sister, look at that human being right there and consider them and what you're thinking about. Consider how they're affected. Consider how they're impacted. Every single one of us ought to be treated with dignity and respect. So yeah, I think that's something we fight in every level of human society. The impulse to dehumanize the other, when I can have what they can't, or when I can get what they can't get, or when I can categorize them in some way as less than or lacking. It's a powerful motivator for human beings. It has to be fought directly.
Well, thank you for this very thought-provoking conversation. I bet some people looked at the title and thought, oh, well, this doesn't impact me, but yet it does on so many levels. Well, finally, on a more lighter note, I have a question for you, Jay, and that is, it's almost summer. So what is one of the most memorable vacations you've ever been on?
Man, you know, there's so many. My wife and I always go on vacation with our kids. We know people that go without them a lot. Maybe we will now that they're getting older. But there was one when I was very new in ministry and we had very little money. And I mean, very little money. And my wife was homeschooling the kids, and somebody offered us a beach house. And right before we went to the beach house, as a way of saying thank you to me for some work that I had done for them and helping somebody with a relative of theirs that was going through something tough, they gave me a honey baked ham. And so my family, with very little money in our pockets, drove down to this incredibly nice beach house with a honey baked ham. And it was maybe the most simple vacation I have ever been on in my life, but it was probably the one I feel the most gratified to have been given at the time that we gave it. There was just something so peaceful and edifying. And just remembering when you watch your kids, because my kids were very young at that time. So watching my kids playing on this beach and enjoying this lovely house and just getting to soak in all of these blessings in the middle of what was a financially very hard time. It was a very hopeful vacation, man. It was great. It was so much fun. It's so much fun that I look back on it and think it will never be that good again, right? Because hopefully I'll never be financially tight like that again. But there's something about God taking care of you when you're financially tight that is, and not just taking care of you, but delivering just a massive amount of love into your life that is just so edifying that it just lasts forever for me. So that's it.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast again.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to episode 342 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Jay Watts. He has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called CRISPR Cures and the New World of Gene Editing, and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern.
In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.